Hi, this is Dr. Linda Papadopoulos with the psychology behind. On the show today, I have Ryan Hart. Now, Ryan's story is harrowing. Back on the 19th of July in 2016, his sister and mother, Claire and Charlotte Hart, were murdered in broad daylight by his father using a sawn-off shotgun. Now, since then, Ryan and his brother, Luke, who are the only two surviving members of the family, have been speaking about the impact this had on their lives. And very importantly, they've been speaking about the impact of coercive control. And you'll find he speaks about this so eloquently within the podcast that you know, while we're able to spot violence within a relationship, while we're often able to spot the sort of the red lights of domestic violence, sometimes coercive control is a bit more difficult to spot. And he said this is what happened with his father, that he was so controlling. He cut off his whole family from any type of support. He didn't allow them to have a narrative that was real. He gave them the narrative to their lives so that all that was going on around them was explained in terms of his worldview and nothing else. And that when he began to lose control, and that's when the violence began. So it truly is a harrowing story, and spoken about so eloquently by this very intelligent, brave, and selfless young man, because it can't be easy to speak about this, yet he and his brother do so in order to raise awareness and to ensure that other people are able to spot coercive control and act on it. So I give you Ryan Hart. I'm delighted that you're here today to speak to us about that, Ryan.
Thank you.
So I guess for starting off, as a kid, was there any indication that what would happen would ultimately happen? Did you live in a household where you saw a lot of fear, that you saw a lot of violence?
So for the first 10 or so years of our life, it was quite idyllic because we lived in a farmhouse, essentially, in the mm-hmm. middle of nowhere. We moved there when I was about 2 years old, until Luke was 11, so for about like 9-10 years. Mm-hmm. We never really bumped into our father that much, to be honest. We had like a lot of space. We just played outside as kids, and we never really got to know him that much.
Is that because he was working a lot, or?
No, so the strange thing was, so our father and our mother didn't actually work for those 10 years in the farmhouse. Okay. We just grew our own food. And I think the space that we had meant we never really felt like we had to be in the home. We enjoyed playing outside with the animals, and we didn't notice anything growing up for those first 10-12 years of our lives. Mm-hmm. There's a key moment, actually. The reason we moved to that farmhouse when I was 2 and Luke was 3 was Luke had an allergic reaction to some nuts, and we were told that it was discovered by an accident, and we were moved to a farmhouse so we could grow our own food, so Luke could be safe, and we knew what he was eating. So before then, for the first 2 years of my life, 3 years of Luke's life, we lived close to our mother's family, mm-hmm. And close to lots of friends in a town. So we moved away from this town to the middle of nowhere. It took mm-hmm. about 30, 40 minutes at least to drive to anyone's house that we knew.
Oh, wow.
But we thought we had moved because it was keeping us safe. After the murders of Mum and Charlotte, we found out from the police investigation that move wasn't to keep us safe. Luke's nut allergy was known by everyone, and our father had force-fed Luke peanuts to show that he was willing to kill us children if our mother didn't obey him.
Oh, my Lord.
And Luke was rushed to hospital, his life was saved. And we were too young to remember that incident, but I think that must have had a real impact on our mum. So as kids, we don't remember anything apart from playing outside.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some really key events when we were really young, when our father demonstrated to our mother that he was willing to take our lives. And I think that showed to us how much control he must have had over our mother from such an early mm-hmm. age that we didn't realise growing up. And like I said, we grew up in this huge farmhouse, like this rundown. We had to spend a couple of years renovating it up, and we just played. So it's quite nice until yeah. we then grew older and had to move to a village about 20-30 miles away, when Luke went to secondary school.
So you had to move because it was time for school, for secondary school, kind of.
Yeah, so the primary school was quite close by. Mm-hmm. And then Luke got a position at a grammar school in Spalding. So that was in Lincolnshire, the county across the border. So we moved to be closer to the school. And we were told it so Luke could get to school easily on the bus. Mm-hmm. It's only about 10 minutes on the bus. Again, after the murders, we found out that that wasn't the case. Even at the funeral for Mum and Charlotte, we had some family friends who asked us, like, where have you been for the last 15 years? Because when we moved from that rundown farmhouse to the village, no one was told where we were going. No one was even told we were leaving. People just found out one day we weren't there anymore. And what had happened was our mother had slowly built up a friendship circle. And our father saw that. And he didn't want anyone, any of us, to really have any friends or any family close by. So he moved us again, even further from Mum's extended family and a circle of friends. So it was, again, we thought it was, oh, you know, our father's taking this move to help us children. But then after the murders, we found out, again, it was an act of isolation. It was severing those ties that we had made.
So who would tell you the stories about why you'd move? So I guess Mom would protect you, and then Dad would tell you, I'm doing this for you. Is that how it would work?
Yeah, so that's what we found out, was the narratives of our lives were told by our father. And so we grew up believing that, oh, these are all kind of done for our best interest. And we only really had his voice to hear from, because I think our extended family were fearful of our father. They knew all this information, but they didn't tell us. I don't know if they felt that they couldn't tell us, or they didn't want to make things dangerous for us, perhaps. So the only information we had was from our father. So we grew up living this almost false life where we didn't actually... It's like almost a Truman Show. We thought everything was fine. There are some things which are happening, which are a bit weird, but it's in our best interest. Until after the murders happened, and we're like, we had to reassess what had gone on and look at things from a different perspective, and found out that our father had controlled our narrative of our lives for 25 years. And I think our mother, she always did the best for us. And growing up, we had no money. We lived in the middle of nowhere, away from friends and family. Mum also had multiple sclerosis, so she could only work part-time. She only earned, I think, £6,000 a year. So she knew that she couldn't bring up three kids by herself. So I think she felt she had to stay with our father so that they could both earn and provide a living for us kids. So I think on Mum's part, it was a sacrifice on her own behalf to give us kids a decent start in life. And for us, we didn't know any better, so we just went along with life, believing what we were told.
Was there any extended family, grandparents, aunts, uncles, or were you kept apart from, so it was just this nuclear family?
Yeah, so we weren't allowed to talk to any of our aunties, uncles, or cousins for about a decade.
Sorry to interrupt. When you say weren't allowed, what would happen if you did?
So this happened when Charlotte was maybe 9 and 11. Mm-hmm. So one of our, I think our cousins were getting married in Australia. And our father took Charlotte with him, and Mum wasn't allowed to go. It wasn't even an option. So our dad, his mum's, our nan and Charlotte, went to Australia for this wedding. And our dad had a falling out with one of our uncles. We only really found out many years later what it was about. So apparently it was quite a simple thing, that they were sharing a villa, all of the extended family, for like the week leading up to the wedding. Mm-hmm. And our father refused to shower before going in the pool, like everyone else did in the villa and the surroundings. And he was asked once to shower, and because he didn't want to, he just erupted, and he ended up blowing it all out of proportion, taking Mum and our nan away from the wedding, missing it, having his own holiday, and banning us from adding on Facebook, from emailing, from talking to any of our extended family at all for close to a decade. And the contact only resumed when our nan developed dementia. And we thought it was because our dad wanted to, you know, get the family close again, like all that missed time, make up for the lost time. And rebuild like the family. And it wasn't. Again, we thought that was the case until after a couple of years of, you know, seeing our cousins and our aunties and uncles regularly, we found out what our father really wanted was he wanted power of attorney over our man's
estate.
So our grandfather passed away many years earlier, and our father had seen his mother as inheritance and nothing more. And he only got in contact with his sister because he needed her to apply for the power of attorney. So again, what we saw was like, oh, you know, our father's maybe regretting the mistakes he made those years, decades earlier, and wants the family to get back together again. Was actually, he saw his mum as just a pile of money, which was being used to give her good care. But he didn't want that. He wanted her to go to the worst, like, care home possible, so he could get all the money. And after about a year of trying and realizing it wasn't possible, again, he just stopped seeing family. So even like in the last few years of Mum and Charlotte's life, we were still having those narratives fed to us. So like, oh no, we should see our family. I don't know why we've not seen our aunties and uncles, he'd say, and he would invite them over and we'd have dinners. And it seemed to be like quite a loving extended family relationship. And then over time, I think Luke and I were older, we were 23, 24, we started to actually see what he was doing. As a kid, we couldn't really see it. But when we started to realize he was applying for power of attorney, and we started to see what he was trying to achieve, we started to see, he doesn't care about his mum. He just wants her money. So throughout our lives, the only times family got to talk to us was when our father saw there was a benefit, a monetary benefit from them getting involved. And so now I can clearly see that he never saw any other human being as a human being. He only ever saw them as machines to provide for him. Like, he saw our mother as someone to cook and clean for him. He saw his mother as inheritance. He saw Luke and I as earning potential. And Charlotte, he saw, I think, as competition for our mum's love. And he saw everyone not as like sentient beings, but as either competition for his role as patriarch or something he can benefit from.
It was all about him, a relation to him. It was individual.
Yeah.
So I understand sort of in those early days, especially sort of these narratives are really easy to kind of keep going.
Yeah.
But as you get older, do you start having conversations with your mom or with your siblings where the three of you are able to talk about your dad's behavior? Or is it so embedded? Is the fear or the worry or anxiety so embedded that you kind of just keep up, even amongst yourselves, the narrative?
So I think growing up, because we only ever had one family, that's what we thought life was. We thought that parents had this, I don't know, invisible level of stress, things to deal with, which means that they get angry. And we thought all fathers were like our father. We thought that our lives were kind of gritty and hard, and each day was not really enjoyable. But we were kind of led to believe that, you know, we're not starving to death. We're not in Africa. We're not being beaten. So we're, I think, living good lives. And our father would say things like that. He'd even say to our mother, you know, once she went out and spent £3 on coffee, and when she got back, he was like, you know, most men would beat you for what you've done. I'm not going to punch you. You're lucky you've got a man like me.
Wow.
And so throughout our lives, he would make us believe that our lives were actually okay. And we had nothing to reference them to. So we never really discussed about possibility of leaving and starting a different life, because we didn't even know that another life was possible. And it wasn't really until I went to university and I started to live with other people that I realized that life, like, you can wake up each day and be happy. Like, you don't have to go through each day just kind of waiting for the next time to be shouted at. Like, people can be quite nice to live with. And that is when, like, it's quite weird to think I was like 18 years old when I started to realize that, hang on a minute, life can actually be quite enjoyable. And that's when I think I started to talk to Mum about what I'd been experiencing at uni. Like, you know, I think at home, this is not a nice environment for all of us. And our father's creating this. We can have something better. But it wasn't really until about 5 years later that I had earned started earning money.
Yeah.
Because I had the ideas, but we were in poverty because our father would gamble and waste money and we had no savings. So he made sure we had no routes of escape.
Even with the kids?
Yeah, so like we had no savings. He never gave us any money to help with our student loans. He, in fact, he would help us get into the debt quite easily. He wouldn't let mum work more than part-time. He worked as minimum as he could so that we had like just enough savings to get us through the week, so that if we wanted to get up and leave, we would be homeless, basically. So I had a good idea when I was 18. I started to see that life could be better, but I couldn't provide anything for mum and Charlotte. And I think Luke also started to see that, yes, we can, or we should do something about this and we can have a better life. But we knew that if we were to leave, we didn't want to just leave and then be homeless. We wanted to leave and start a life, start a new life. So we had to have some money to be able to rent somewhere so we could at least have somewhere to start our new lives. So for about 4 or 5 years, I knew that our life was awful, but I was just waiting until I could earn money, save up, and rent somewhere for Mum and Charlotte to run away to. And also we knew that a separation would be quite difficult and stressful, and we never thought it'd be dangerous, but we knew it would be a very hard time for Mum and Charlotte. So we thought that, and Mum also thought that if Charlotte was away at university, then it'd be much easier.
Right.
Because it would just be her. She didn't want to put Charlotte through that process, whatever it would have involved.
And what's the age difference between you and Charlotte? So at this point, how old is Charlotte when you start talking?
Charlotte was, I think, 6 years younger than us.
Okay, so quite a bit.
Quite
so
a bit younger
at
than
18,
us.
She's still 12 when you start thinking about this. By the time you're in your 20s, she's still a young teenager.
Yeah, so we kind of knew that we had to get our heads down, work hard, get good jobs. And then once Charlotte had left the university, then the enforced poverty that our father had created, if Luke and I were earning, we could break that barrier. We could pay for them to live somewhere else. The dependency of having us kids to look after, that was no longer valid if we were all grown up and university. And the isolation, we could break that down. I mean, Mum had made so many friends. Everyone was willing to help her. So we knew that those three kind of levers were what were holding us trapped.
Right.
And we kind of knew that once we'd earned enough money after a year or so of working, we could break free. So that's what we did in about the middle of early June, I think, 2016. Was when we started to look for somewhere to rent. And we only moved out 5 days before he then murdered Mum and Charlotte. So when we thought we were safe and we were just starting a new life, it was actually the most danger we'd actually ever been in. And we didn't realise that at the time. Only now we know that I think 75% of women who are murdered by their partners are murdered after they leave. So they are hunted down. So when we were kind of relaxed and feeling happy, we should have actually been on edge and, and kind of quite concerned.
Can you take me back to that day if it's not too hard?
Yeah, sure. So 5 days before we'd moved out, I was working in Holland at the time and Luke was in Aberdeen.
Okay.
So we took a day off work, we flew back.
Oh, so it's planned, you're like, okay, we're going to do
this. It was planned, yeah. So we actually only planned to move, we only found the place like a week before. It was very rushed, like we knew we had to do something quick because the tensions at home just seemed to be escalating. I don't know if our father knew anything. I don't actually think he did know anything, but he could sense that his control over us was leaving. And I just felt something was quite getting like to a crescendo. So Mum and I worked really quick. We found somewhere to rent. Luke and I booked a day off work, got the moving van and moved out. That was on a Thursday. And then we both had the Friday at home as well on the weekend with Mum in the new house with the dogs. And it was really nice. We went back to work on that Sunday night. So Luke got a train to Aberdeen and I flew back to Holland. Charlotte came back on the Monday. So she only ended up having one night at the new home. So on the Tuesday morning, on the 19th, I woke up quite early, like 5 o'clock, went to the gym. Like I was feeling absolutely amazing. Like I had so many plans for holidays, for concerts, for everything that Mum was denied growing up and in her adult lives, everything Charlotte was denied growing up, I wanted to start providing for them. So I had a whole list of different European cities we're going to go to. I was almost going to book Wimbledon tickets for Mum because she'd only ever watched it from TV at home and she'd always wanted to go and watch it live. So I think that morning when I was walking to the gym, I was searching for Wimbledon tickets and I kind of found some I was going to buy on that evening. Went to the gym, went to work, and I was actually only 2 or 3 weeks into this new job. So it's a new job for me. It's a new company and a new country as well. So it's quite a lot going on. And then about midday, just after lunch, I got back to my desk and I just wanted like 5 minutes just to kind of zone out because it's quite a busy and quite a stressful day. Just scrolling through the news app on my phone. And that's when I saw the breaking news headline of 3 dead in shooting in Spalding. And it just seemed to be a coincidence at the time because I never really believed that our father would do that because I was always under the impression that he would gradually get more and more violent. And I thought because he was never violent to us, he wasn't any danger to us. It never once crossed my mind that he would hurt anyone. So I messaged Mum and Charlotte, didn't hear anything back. I called up Luke. I think he must have missed a few phone calls. I kept trying like his work number, his colleagues' numbers. Got through to him eventually, told him what I saw. Again, he was just like, I just call the local police. I'm sure it's not them, like just a big mistake. So I called the local police and they asked for a few contact details for me, for Luke. And it seemed to be just routine stuff, just maybe just gathering all the information they might need so they can call you back to let you know if that it's not them afterwards. Mm-hmm. And they said they'll call me back. I kind of worked myself up quite a bit. I was crying at the time. So I messaged my boss. I was like, I need to leave the office. I was in just a quiet room next to the office. I thought, I need to go back to my hotel room just to calm down.
Yeah.
I remember actually emailing him saying, I know it's not them, but I've just worked myself up too much that I can't work today. I'll see you in the morning. So I just took my phone, wallet, and headed back to my hotel room, waiting for the return call from the police. Mm-hmm. And there's a family liaison officer who called me back. That should have really confirmed my worst nightmares, but I think my mind just couldn't comprehend it, so it refused to kind of accept it, I think, to protect me. And I was still imagining that it was a coincidence and a mistake. And she was getting details again of like friends and families and asking where I was. She sounded quite surprised that I was in Holland. She's like, oh, where's Luke? He's in Aberdeen. Because it happened in Lincolnshire, so it's like quite far away. I think she's expecting we were in neighbouring towns or cities. And I know that now that she was trying to find if she could come to us or they could send someone to us. She's asking if I had anyone with me. I didn't. And I could tell, now looking back, I could tell that she is trying best to prepare me for the news. And it must have took maybe 2 hours at least more before I had to accept what had happened, because obviously she was trying to find the best way to get the news across to me and also find out what to do, how Luke and I should come together, where and when. And it wasn't until a phone call later, I got maybe an hour after that phone call, that it was one of Mum's colleagues from work on the line, and he just said, come home, mate, come home. That's when I knew it was Mum and Charlotte. So then I had a friend in the office in Holland. I just told her, like, I told her before then, like, this is what I've seen on the news. I'm just a bit scared. I'm just back in my hotel room. And then after that phone call, I just texted her saying, you know, it's them. So she came back to the hotel. She bought my belongings. She booked us flights and she helped me get back to London. So I flew back to London. Luke came from Aberdeen. Mm-hmm. And then the next few days, weeks, months, even years almost, were just a bit of a blur, to be honest. Just trying to understand how what happened could have happened. And it was, to start with, I think just confusion. And there was confusion in the media too, I think. That's why I think our story reached the headlines, because there was no violence. We never went to any services beforehand. We were not in any radars. We were not high risk. We just like seemed to be a normal family.
Yeah.
Successful kids, nice big house. Like, how could this have happened? And that confusion lasted for quite a while until we started to piece together our lives and, like I said, take like a new perspective of our lives and realize that much of our lives was a lie.
Yeah.
And that we weren't actually understanding what was going on because we were being fed the truth by our father. Mm. Whereas actually it was kind of those narratives that he was feeding us to keep us believing his lie.
Under control.
Yeah.
So that morning he just woken up, and even though your sister and your mom were at this new place,
yeah,
he'd managed to find them and just showed up.
Yeah, so he'd actually arranged to meet Mum and Charlotte there. So
okay.
It was all part of the divorce proceedings, I guess. Okay. The divorce hadn't started.
Right.
But Mum and my father had agreed to meet at that car park, swimming pool car park, to then exchange some documents, because we left in a rush. That day we left the house, we grabbed what we could and left before he came back home for lunch. So we had left some family photos that Charlotte wanted, and we'd maybe taken some documents like his, I don't know, driving license, paperwork or something. And he wanted the meeting under the disguise of like, oh, we should, you know, hand back these things you'd taken by mistake, and I'll give you this, and let's go to the bank maybe, and we can close the bank account. So
again, it seemed really innocuous. Seemed like almost a positive step of, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we were arranging that over the weekend that Luke and I were there. Mm-hmm. Like, I was telling Mum, like, yes, I'm happy for you to meet him again. Mm. Just don't go to the house. Do it in public because you'll be safe. I mean, I told her that. I told her that she'd be safe if she met him that morning. And that affected me quite a lot because that obviously that led to me believing that I was responsible. Took quite a long time to get
did
over
that really
it right? did yeah so
but how on what planet would you have ever anticipated that?
I think when you go through trauma, you start to I started to imagine every other avenue that our lives could have taken, like every decision point. I was like, I could have made this yes or no, and there are so many forks. And I must have spent the first year when I was sleeping dreaming of every other situation that we could have been in. And for me, that one stuck was when I was at home and said, you'll be safe if you go and meet him in public because he's too concerned about his reputation. And he was.
And he was. And given all the information that you had, that was absolutely correct. And I think this is what's so interesting about your story. You know, think about it. You have professionals that should have been there that wouldn't have seen this because, you know, you couldn't see bruises and you couldn't see cuts. And it was a big house and it was professional kids. All of these things. Are you in a place now where you see that you couldn't have stopped it?
Yeah. So it took me. So it took a year of just I think just living each day, hoping time would heal. And also, I think that first year, we were kind of rebuilding our perspective on our lives. And then I started to see a therapist, and that really helped
me.
Kind of realize finally that what he did was his choice and not mine. And that I'm not responsible. And that took a long time to get to that stage. But yeah, on that morning, so it was a planned meet. Mum and Charlotte were going to go swimming afterwards, and we found out that he had even purchased a parking ticket 20 minutes before killing Mum, Charlotte and himself. So that day was like a routine day for him. He hadn't lost his mind, he hadn't lost control over his emotions.
So do you think the purchasing of the parking ticket was because he planned, he wasn't sure if he'd do it or not? Or was it just running through the motions? What was that about?
So he had written a murder note.
He had.
And he'd printed it out, had it on his car seat, he had the keys to the house, a little note for the police saying, please don't break the door down. He had the keys to the house. He's more worried about damaging a front door of the house when he's just about to go and murder two women. And we found out from the police investigation that he was actually writing his murder note before we had even started to plan to move out. So he was going to kill all of us at home. And now we know that was purely because he felt his control over us diminishing as we were earning and Mum was making friends. So we were all going to be killed at home, and it would have been one of those mysteries, like, you know, wives and children like stabbed in their sleep, what had happened. But it turned out that he'd gone through many drafts, and the day that we left, he updated his draft, and his new convenient reasoning was, my wife had left me and she's taken the kids and she's taken out these belongings and she's done this. And it formed quite a convenient narrative around why he was going to murder. And it frustrated us knowing that, that the media kind of latched onto, oh, you know, the wife's left, so he's done this, out of emotional reaction.
Yeah.
But actually, he had been planning to kill us all purely because he felt like his control over our lives was slowly going away. So the killing wasn't an emotional reaction.
No, no.
It was purely cold-bloodedly planned.
And fantasized over for years, it seems, yeah. In like different drafts. That's
yeah, I mean, and he also Googled about men who murdered their families. Like, he was doing this when we were sitting in the same room as him. Like, looking at the dates of the drafts, we were at home sitting there in the living room and he was typing about how he's going to kill us all. And we now come to realize that what he did wasn't an emotional reaction. It was like an ideological belief system that he just carried through to the conclusion.
Yeah.
He had been planning to kill us all for decades. I mean, he showed with the action with the peanuts when Luke was three.
Yeah.
He was happy to kill us if it just proved his point. Like, we meant nothing to him ever. So that's kind of one key point we're getting across, that our father, it wasn't emotionally decided. It wasn't kind of hot-headed.
No.
It wasn't a reaction.
No.
He was going about his day-to-day jobs. And the reason he murdered us all, because he believed we were his possessions. And we had angered him. And we had, I think, embarrassed him as, like, man of the house that we had left.
That's a really interesting point. This idea of this, people throw around the word toxic masculinity, and sometimes I think it's used in sort of, you know, frivolous ways, but there is something so toxic about what he saw as strength, what he saw as being the man of the house, as indicative of that identity. Like, I'm loath to use the word caricature, because a caricature is almost something quite funny. It was unbelievably pathological, this, you know, how he conflated control and coercion and violence, emotional violence, with masculinity or manhood.
Yeah, so he tried to force Luke and I in his image, and luckily, we saw that and we had our mum and sister to aspire to be like. So they were our role models growing up. Because I'd hate to have been like my father. So we're lucky we had a good role model, a good parent that we could look at and be inspired by. But yeah, he believed that a man is entitled to a woman and the marriage is a contract of her life. And he believed that children are brought into this world by him, so we are there to serve him. And he would get angry at me because when I came home for weekends, I just wanted to spend it with mum and Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, you should be down at the pub with your mates. That's what men do.
Wow.
And he had this really traditional view of a man and a masculinity. And we now realize that is the sole reason that he behaved the way he did, was because he felt that he was entitled to and he felt that he was right in controlling us, in abusing us. And he felt that he was doing the right thing in murdering. He felt that we had disobeyed him and we had challenged the patriarchy that was so important in his world that death was a worthy punishment.
Yeah. Well, he was entitled. He was entitled to demand whatever it was, the warped respect, whatever he saw it as, or obedience, or and so forth. And sort of the narcissism around it as well, that you weren't individuals and that any affront was, you know, this punishable literally by death.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think the key thing is that these men who murder, and also the men who are violent to or abuse or control, they believe that they're entitled to. And that's, I think, entirely the issue. It's not that these men have emotional outbursts and they go, oh God, I didn't know what happened, sorry. Like, that happens to us every now and then.
Yeah.
But it's part of a structure, this abuse. Like, coercive control in particular is part of a structure of abuse over years and decades. And that structure doesn't happen randomly, repeatedly. It happens because these men believe they're entitled to control. And it's part of, I think, society enforces that almost, or helps build the environment that these men can control and abuse, because only after the murders Luke and I have started to really get, I guess, engaged in the field of domestic abuse, because we never really knew about it beforehand, and we've started to read into feminism and what it means, and only now do we see how the voice of society in the media, in TV and news, is very male dominated. And if you read about women who are murdered, it's always, you know, she left him, or she had an affair, or she did this, she did that. There's never, the man has committed this offence. It's always, why is she done to provoke him? And we've come to realise that there's a lot of victim blaming around domestic abuse. Yeah. And it's almost seen that society is very patriarchal still. And I think that is also the issue. We need an equal, fair society.
Indeed.
We need a society where women are treated as human beings and not partners of successful men. Yeah. And they have their own lives and they...
Contribute
and like... Yeah. Women who want to have a better life, you shouldn't be demonised for doing that. Like,
oh God, no.
I think our mum felt a stigma for leaving.
Even that much pain.
Even after
and...
like decades of abuse, I think she felt like staying with our father was almost what she should do. And I'm not surprised if there's many women out there who feel the same because...
Well, because their value lies. And so the same way that you have toxic masculinity, you have these ridiculous indicators of success for a woman to be a good partner, to put up, to have this, you know, all of these ideas. And what does that mean? But the other thing that that you raised, I think is really interesting, is when I've worked with people that have experienced domestic violence, oftentimes control is distorted and seen as a way of caring. So I've literally sat across from women that have been so damaged by the abuse that, well, no, but he screams and shouts and he'll get aggressive, but that's only when I'm being that. So it's the excuse, the rationalization that it's my fault and I deserve it. And actually, I don't deserve more. And I think ultimately, you know, you put up with things because you begin to think you deserve it and you make sense of it. So you make sense of someone screaming at you or having a coffee with someone who's like, he's jealous because he loves me. He's jealous because... Yeah. So it's not seen as a serious personality flaw in the other. It's seen as a personality flaw in the victim.
Yeah,
as you say,
that's the case for us as well. So because we couldn't change our environment, I think the only way to survive each day was to try and understand it and try and mold ourselves to live there. And the only way to understand it was to try and believe that we could change it. We couldn't ever change our father. Sure. We couldn't change our poverty. We couldn't change the fact we were isolated.
Yeah.
But we could try and change ourselves. And we kept getting told that we were the reason for him shouting at us. So in order to try and improve that, we were like, okay, it's us doing it. We have to change ourselves. So we started to then blame ourselves for what he was doing. And that has had quite a big effect on me, I think. And I've started to realize that domestic abuse, children aren't witnesses to domestic abuse. I've realized now, just from myself, that seeing someone else being abused and also living in a controlling environment really has a huge impact on your personality. As you start to control yourself, like you said, you start to believe that you are at fault because you're told it day in, day out.
Mm-hmm.
And you start to really mold yourself into this really tight fit, which allows you to survive because your space for action is so small that you just learn to live in that small space rather than living freely like most children or people would.
Yeah. Well, you retreat, don't you?
So
in this podcast, one of the things that we try and do even with... when we're trying to kind of make sense of a challenge and to call what you went through a challenge feels a huge minimization. It's unbelievable what you and your family went through. But if you were to speak about a moment, a comfort, and then sort of a forward-facing challenge or compass to kind of you orientate yourself to, what would that seminal moment be in all of this experience that made you learn something or think about something in a different way?
The moment for me, and I think it's the same moment for Luke, it's quite a light bulb moment when we're sat in a police station 2 days after the murders, confused at how our life came to this point. We seemed to be living an ordinary life. We thought we had an ordinary life. We thought we were safe. And then we looked behind us and we saw a poster talking about domestic abuse and coercive control. It didn't mention violence at all, but it was almost a CV for our father. It mentioned the emotional abuse, the financial control, the making you feel like you're responsible, the arbitrary rules which are constantly changing so you never be right. And it mentioned everything that our father did that we thought were just small things. And then we realized that we were living with an abusive father for 25 years and we didn't know it. And we were living in a domestic abuse household and we didn't know it.
Isn't that something that the like you said before, not being able to see the wood for the trees. Because you're right, when you're in it, and I think one of the biggest assets to an abuser is isolation. If I isolate, you have nothing to measure against on. If there's no background color, then how do you know what color you're living, right? With you, there was nothing around there, and so
It's only when this like huge traumatic event that we had to then reevaluate and kind of understand what happened. I think had the murders not happened, we never would have really been forced to confront our past lives. And it was only in that police station that we realized that the murders didn't make sense if we're looking at it from a point of violence.
Mm.
If we're looking for increasing levels of violence, it makes no sense at all. But if we're looking for increasing levels of control and increasing steps that our father went to maintain control, then it made perfect sense. And that's when we realized that abuse is all about control, and violence is just a means to gain that control. And many men don't need to use violence. They can maintain control via other ways, like our father did.
Mm-hmm.
And the murders were an ultimate act of control over our lives, basically, because the financial control was gone. Luke and I were earning money. The dependence upon children had gone because we'd all grown up. Isolation was gone. Mum had a smartphone. Mum had friends. She had people willing to help her anytime she wanted to help. So all of those methods that our father put in place to control us were gone. And so he ratcheted up everything he could do. I mean, in the final few weeks before we left, he was threatening to burn the house down. He's making threats against us kids. He was doing everything he could. And then when we left, I think he realized his only option remaining was, before we disappeared and he never saw us again, was to murder us, as many of us as he could, the next time he saw us.
Which is what was in these letters that he was
writing. Which is what was in the letters. So we kind of realized that moment in the police station that our lives had been controlled by our father, and that was his aim, was to control us. And that is the aim of abusers in general, is control. And if you're looking for a caricature of a violent man, then you won't see it 99% of the time. But if you're looking for the control, and you recognize that violence is just part of a method of actions that these men use to maintain control, then domestic abuse is much more visible, and you realize how prevalent that is.
That's so well put. I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head. How have you coped? What's been your comfort through this? What's been the thing you've used? Because I want to highly recommend, while I'm saying this, it's called Operation Lighthouse, and this is written by you and your brother.
Yeah.
And it's about reflections on our family's devastating story of coercive control and domestic homicide. Was that part of how you found comfort, because you are so unbelievably knowledgeable in this? Was it seeking out knowledge about this?
So the book never intended to be created. It started out in the forms of speeches. So we were invited. So after a year of living in that small house we'd rented from Mum Charlotte, we went back to work. Luke got a job in London, so we moved down to London, or Surrey. And we were invited to share our story with police officers to help in their understanding of coercive control, because it only just came into law. So it's quite a new thing, coercive control. So to help these officers understand what it's like for a victim, we were asked if we wanted to share our story. And it's quite scary. It's quite a few tears the first time we told it. But we saw from the questions afterwards, like, how much impact our story had. And we had people coming up to us afterwards saying, like, can you speak to this force? Can you come back again? And we ended up, what was meant to be just one visit turned into five. And we realized that these speeches have so much value in them. And we were going to conferences and, like, we're just expanding throughout the country, almost telling our story. And we started to realize that we needed to share our story more widely than just people in professional fields, because we came to realize that it's everyone who needs to know, and everyone has to be able to spot these signs.
Absolutely.
And the book had actually started when we were in that small home. I think Luke had started to write down his feelings, because we were grieving at different stages, and we were recovering at different stages. And Luke knew that he couldn't talk to me face to face because I wasn't at the same stage as he was. So he wrote down his thoughts so that I could read them when I was ready, and vice versa. And so a little bit of a story had kind of came together in that year. And then we started to share our story more widely. And a police officer came to us actually and said, you should write a book. Like, this is so valuable. And then I think we decided we need to kind of make a proper book out of this. Yeah. So we kind of took the speeches, we took what we'd written to redefine our lives. So we had to understand the perspective of our lives again. We had to understand the nut allergy incident. We had to understand all of those things which before were convenient, helpful acts from my father were actually damaging, controlling, isolating acts. So we had to re-understand our lives and also understand what we were going to make of our lives.
So would you say that the comfort was in telling your story of in you taking control of the narrative that he'd taken control of for so long that you got to take it back?
I think partly that understanding our lives and recognizing that we were not to blame and recognizing that we can live like our mum and our sister would have wanted, and we don't have to be like eternally, I don't know, punished from what our father did. So he wanted to ruin our lives too, and understanding that helped me realize I need to do something positive out of this, because if we just live a life of regret and sorrow, our father's won and our mum and our sister would not have been pleased. Like, we want them to be smiling if they could be here now. So the book was partly to honor mum and Charlotte, to give them the voice that was taken from them, and it was also in recognizing that we could save lives and stop what happened to us happening again. And I think the key turning point, so we're kind of going through drafts and we didn't really have a firm structure as to like how we're going to publish it or when, but we went to a conference and we shared our story and we met a lady and she told us, it's in the book in fact, what she sent to us. We asked her if we could share it in the book because it hit us so hard. She said that a colleague of hers had went to a conference that we spoke at, and she recognized what we talked about in her friend. So she invited her friend to come and see us at our next conference. And her friend came over, this lady, she came over, she listened to what we said. And she recognized that her household was exactly the same as what we were describing we went through. And so she left in a hurry. She got the police involved. I think she just didn't feel safe because we told her, like, you know, the control, look for these elements of control. The police went round to her house. I don't know what for, but they went round to the house and they found weapons and they found intent that her husband was actively planning to kill her and her children. And so she told us that had we not been to that conference and shared our story, she might have been murdered by her father within those few weeks.
So when you talk about saving lives, there's like proof right there.
Yeah, so we read that and we thought, wow, there's meaning in this. We need to get this out. So that's when we sat down and said, look, let's set a deadline. Let's really work hard. Let's go through the drafts. Let's get this done. And we put the short extract of what that lady said in the book because it means so much to us to know that we're making a difference. And I think that for us is our comfort. That is knowing that all the pain that we've been through, and all the pain that we're still going through, it isn't pain if there's purpose. And it's bearable if we know that there's something good coming out of it. So
that's your comfort.
That's our comfort. Even though we can be like crying our eyes out on stage, if we're getting through to somebody what is happening and what happened to us, and if we can save one person from living, not necessarily from being killed, but from not having ever lived in the first place as well. That's also
well,
one
that's
thing.
Actually such a good point. So we're talking about quality of life, not just extending life, but actually having a life.
Yeah, so that's one thing that we say often is that we weren't moving from our father because we were afraid that he would kill our mum and our sister. We were moving out because we were afraid that mum could never get to live in the first place. And I think that is key, that yes, two women a week are murdered, but countless women don't get to live in the first place because they are being controlled and abused by these men. So that's just as important in my eyes, is freeing these women as well as saving those who were going to be murdered. So for us, I think that is what gets us through those hard days, is knowing that everything we go through is for something better and is to hopefully one day mum and Charlotte's lives and their message will stop domestic abuse. It's quite a big goal, but I think it's worth having a big goal and doing everything you can to make the world a better place, really.
So what's your challenge for the future? Where are you moving towards? What does the future hold?
I think there's quite a few challenges for us. I think there's some personal challenges for me. So growing up, my father never let me do any sports. he never let me do anything which cost money or which enabled me to make friends or enabled me to potentially find out what was going on at home by experiencing happiness elsewhere. So for me, the personal challenge is sports. Like, I really enjoy sports now and music. So I've taught myself to play the piano a little
Amazing.
Bit. I've taken up skydiving.
Okay.
I'm quite an active swimmer and cyclist. And I found, like, throughout my childhood, I was denied the chance of doing anything that cost any money at all. I wasn't allowed to have lifts home from after school clubs. So I missed out on so much sport and excitement growing up. Like, a personal challenge of me is to find out what I enjoy. Like, I'm Amazing. 27 and I'm trying to find out now what I enjoy in life.
Yeah.
So I've been experimenting with different sports.
What do you like? What's your sport?
So for me, swimming is really, I'm really getting into that. So I'm really taking that forward quite a lot and trying to just, I think, enjoy sports. I found that that's really my thing now. Relationships for me is also a new thing. So I never had a relationship growing up because one, my self-esteem and self-confidence was destroyed by my father. So in order to, I guess, make me more subservient to him, he made me feel like I was an awful kid. And I believed that. So now I'm having to kind of tell myself that I'm worthy of someone else. So a relationship is something I want to try and build towards. And also, it sounds strange, but I want to do it for my mum as well, because I might cry now.
It's okay.
I could remember how proud she was when Charlotte would have a boyfriend or when Luke would have a girlfriend. And I just knew that she wanted me to have someone as well in my life. So for me to meet somebody is something mum would have wanted. So sorry.
Oh, no, not at all. I
think that's something for me that would be really quite big.
You certainly deserve it. And clearly speaking as a Greek mom, I don't know, because but having your child kind of know that they're worth love, and I sincerely hope you know that now, I think is the ultimate, and she'd be so proud. I have no doubt. I mean, to take something so horrific, Ryan, and to turn it into something that saves people, to turn it into reflection of self, and to not be the kid that your father saw, to be the kid that your mother saw, because that's where the choice is, you know. You get to be her son. You get to be the boy that she saw, and she saw your potential and your beauty, and you've blown it out of the water. You've done amazing.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, I think Luke and I are trying to show we're not our father's sons, we're our mother's sons, our sister's brothers.
Absolutely. So
we're not defined by what he did to us, we're defined by what we choose to do. So that's what we're trying to do with the book and with our lives, I think, is trying to show that there's no excuse for what he did, and there's no excuse for being violent or controlling or abusive, and that everything is down to a choice. And even having been through horrendous trauma, you can still choose to be good.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what we also want to try and show, is that everything that we do is an active choice, and every day you can choose to be better, regardless of what you've been through or who you've been. You can always choose to be someone better. So hopefully we can also get that message across to people. And also, I think also trying to be an inspiration to other people, trying to show that you can come through 25 years of abuse. You can come through the most awful moment in your life. Like, I went through some very, very difficult times, emotionally, mentally. I think I'm quite lucky also to be here still. Like, I went through some very difficult times. So in terms of mental health as well, I kind of want people to see that you can come through some almost impossible times in your life. Like, our father tried to enforce this idea that you shouldn't cry, you shouldn't talk to anyone, you should be a strong man. And he was miserable. And if I tried to hold on to those beliefs, I would be miserable too. And I think Luke and I want to show that to be a man isn't about not crying and doing everything yourself. Like, to be a man is about love and compassion. Like, it's about being a human, and it's about needing help when you need help, and it's about crying when you need to cry, and about...
Well, that's what bravery is, right? And I think that's the paradox, that in a lot of ways, what you encompass is the most beautiful side of masculinity. It's the strength of feeling the fear but facing it.
Yeah.
It's the bravery of standing up to stuff instead of just kind of going along with what's said. It's the bravery of kind of getting to rewrite your own script and be there for yourself as much as others. Honestly, Ryan, it's been, and I don't use this word lightly, it's been a genuine honor speaking and a privilege speaking to you. Thank you for being so honest to share your story. I have no doubt that it will impact men and women, people, you know, that are either going through this or, like you said, know someone. I could not recommend this book highly enough. It's Operation Lighthouse, Luke and Ryan Hart, and it's published by, who's it published by? Seven Dials. So we'll make sure that we put a link on it to the podcast as well. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, that was truly inspiring, speaking to someone that's experienced so much trauma and pain, being able to turn it around. You know, I think that I feel so privileged as a psychologist because I sit across from people who are able to kind of find meaning within things that are so destructive and so painful. And I think in Ryan's case, the meaning is something so beautiful. He's been able to take his story and turn it into something positive that will impact lives, that will save lives. So I urge you to read more about his story, to pick up the book Operation Lighthouse, which is by Ryan and Luke, his brother, Luke and Ryan Hart, and to look around you. You know, we often speak about how in a society that's so connected, we feel isolated. So I wonder if, you know, we looked around us a little bit more and were able to kind of highlight things that just didn't sit right. You know, if we did that for each other, if maybe we'd be able to spot things like coercive control to help each other realize that, well, that it's not okay and to potentially get out of it. So a million thank yous again to Ryan for coming in today. I hope that you took something away from that. As always, it's wonderful to hear your ideas. Please do let me know what you're thinking of the podcast. If there's other issues that you want me to speak about, if there's other stories that you think need to be heard, do let me know. Reach out to me, subscribe, share, review, and get in touch with me as always. And until we meet again, I wish you a very healthy, happy body and